Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and today my guest is indie horror movie filmmaker, connoisseur, and just generally nice but strange guy, Mike Lombardo. Hi, Mike.
Howdy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for lying to the audience. I appreciate that. I'm actually a monster, but...
You know. No, I was introduced to you through the horror show with Brian Keene, his podcast, and you were described adorably, frequently, over the several years that I've listened, and we finally met at Scares That Care this year, and you are adorable and sweet with just a well-controlled inner dark side.
Well, thank you. I hope that the FBI take heed of that. That it's well controlled. Get me off some watch lists.
Believe it or not, there's a series of books out there by now I'm drawing a blank on his name. He's one of the guys on Writing Excuses. Dan Wells, and his main character is a teenage sociopath who is a serial killer, but his target is demons.
Oh, is it that I'm Not a Serial Killer?
Yes.
That book? I haven't. Yes. I saw the trailer for the movie, and when the book came out, I almost bought it. I've heard good things. Is it worth picking up?
Yes, it is. I have the first three books, and the movie is supposed to come out on Netflix one of these days. I thought it was supposed to come out this year, but it hasn't yet, so I'm going to say, hey, Netflix, where is it? Yeah. Either it did come out and I missed it. I'm not sure, but I've heard good things about both the movie and the book. I've read the first two. I have the first three. I enjoyed the first one. The voice of the character is quite entertaining. And I'm serious when I say, yeah, that kid reminds me of you.
I'll definitely pick them up. I just have about six crates of books to catch up on before then, but I'll get through it.
So how long have you been making horror videos, horror movies, horror shorts?
I've been doing this since I was a kid. So I'm 31 now. And I was the first time that I recall picking up a camera with the intent of shooting something. I was probably about, say, 10 or 11. I was trying to shoot my magnum opus, Flowers for Algernon 2, Algernon's Revenge. I was reading the story, and I believe I was in 7th grade. I was reading the original book, and I thought this would make a great zombie movie with a killer mouse. So that was the first attempt at making a film. And then from then, I had my trusty VHS camcorder, and I just shot all sorts of stuff that will never see the light of day. until I got very serious about it when I was in high school, which was about 2002 is when I got a real camera for the first time. And we shot three movies, Gore's Order of the Max times 3, Manhunt, I Was an Impressionable Teenager, which was a parody of the video game Manhunt, which is about snuff movies. That was causing a big controversy with the Columbine and all that kind of shit. Like, they were claiming that it caused people to kill kids to be influenced to kill. So we kind of made a parody of that. And then Chainsaw Chink versus Santa Claus, which was the first time we used Santa Claus in anything, which became an obsession throughout my entire life and career. Most notably, and I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday. But yeah, I mean, I've been doing shorts that whole time. I think I directed something like 14 or 15 short films. And then Doomsday is my first feature.
What led you to lean towards horror?
The legend goes that when I was born, they had to put screws in my head to monitor my heart rate. Something, there was some kind of problem during the birthing process. And apparently, since then, my mom got me, when I was a kid, my first doll was a Frankenstein doll, I guess, as a cute little homage to the time I almost died. But ever since I was a kid, apparently I carried that doll around and I was obsessed with horror stuff. When I was in nursery school, I cried every day when my mom would leave, when she dropped me off, until Halloween came up and I had all the skeletons and bats and jack-o'-lantern decorations. Then they said that I just completely chilled out and I was super happy. I didn't want to leave then, So it's been a lifelong obsession. I really don't know why. I just have always gravitated towards it.
Well, the progression of effects, the use of effects, the use of sound in the series of short films that you've done that I've seen is both unique, creative, and unusual. Because some of the effects that you use are very effective, and that points to a unique talent at managing micro budgets.
Well, thank you. That's micro budget is generous for the budgets that we've had in the past. I think we're a step below that generally, but yeah, the effect stuff I've always been obsessed with too. The Halloween store was kind of like Mecca for me. So every year I would, you know, troll the Halloween store as often as I could. And then the day after Halloween, I would pick up all of the masks and special effects stuff, you know, when it was on clearance.
Mm.
And I just taught myself how to do effects work. Actually, I almost, in an alternate reality somewhere, I would have done it. I almost went to effects school when I graduated high school. I was really going to go to the Tom Savini School in Madison, PA, but I did not do that. I chose to pursue writing and directing instead. Not to say that I went to school for that either. I just taught myself, but I came very close to dedicating my life to special effects, which is something that still kind of keeps me up at night sometimes when I watch like extra features on a lot of the stuff from like Scream Factory, like watching the behind the scenes of like Day of the Dead or Creepshow, especially the Leviathan documentary about Hellraiser, which is my favorite movie. I watched like an hour and a half of just raw camcorder behind the scenes of them in the effects shop just kind of making stuff, and it literally brings me to tears because I was like, that was the life I always wanted. But I don't know, I have to write, I have to direct, I can't not do those things. It's a compulsion, not a choice. So the effects are just kind of a fun side thing, I guess.
Talk about your approach to doing the effects, because you, in addition to writing and directing these shorts and features, you are managing the special effects too.
Yeah, so that, I mean, a lot of the positions that I take on a film set come out of necessity and not choice, just because there's not a lot of crew members to go around, so everyone has to wear a lot of hats. But the effects work is something, like I said, I've always loved doing. So it's very difficult because when you are, you know, a writer or a director, or I guess not so much a writer because you're generally the writer's job is done when the script is finished. But when I'm not actually on set, I go home, and then instead of prepping the next day's shot lists, I'm prepping effects work too. And that's really difficult to do when you're on set because you want, especially when I was doing Doomsday, because I wanted to spend time with the actors because it's a dramatic piece. But the days where we had heavy effects work, I want to make sure everything looks the best. And trying to juggle those two things is extremely difficult, which is one of the reasons that I stopped shooting my own stuff. I got people to do the camera work for me. One, because they're much better at it than I am. But two is trying to DP something while you're covered in blood is a horrible choice because you get blood on the camera and it's a huge mess. But it's also funny because I generally end up producing the stuff too. So there's the producer is the guy that, you know, tries to keep everything on schedule and making sure that, you know, we're not doing 150 takes of one shot, you know, keep it moving. So the enemy of the producer is the effects artist, and the enemy of the effects artist is the producer. So like, how much longer till it's done? That's every time I do an effects gig, that's all I hear. Well, I'm the director, so I want everything to look perfect, but I'm also the effects guy, so I want the effects to look great. I'm also the producer, so there's really no one to yell at me except for me. So that turns into sometimes 6-7 hours of getting the effects just right, and that's not the most efficient way to make a movie. So in the future, I think I'm going to have somebody to yell at me to keep me moving faster, because that's kind of difficult. But
yeah, as long as the actors and crew aren't watching you argue with yourself for 5 or 10 minutes out loud, I'm going to say it's all good.
Yeah. My split personality very rarely comes out on set.
Uh-huh. You have him tied up in the back, right?
Absolutely.
Now, your first feature came out, when was the official debut? Was it the end of 2017 or was it at the film festivals in 2018?
So it officially world premiered in October, I think it was October 21st of 2017, and that was at Nightmares Film Festival in Columbus, Ohio. So that was our big world premiere, which I cannot say enough good things about that festival. The fest director, Jason Tostin, actually tracked me down and yelled at me for not submitting and world premiering there for a while, and he made some very great points, which ended up coming to fruition beautifully. So I highly recommend anyone that has a movie to submit to Nightmares Film Festival. But it was a huge experience, and we were terrified because I usually do horror comedy, and Doomsday is not funny at all. Doomsday is a very, very, very serious movie. So I'm used to gauging audience reaction by how much they're laughing. And if nobody's laughing, I'm shrinking in my seat, realizing that I did something terribly wrong. Well, during Doomsday, it was dead silent. Nothing, not a peep. The entire hour and 12 minutes, which was like death to me. I was like, oh my God, what have I done? This is horrible. They're going to run me out of town. And the lights came up and they, you know, the credits started rolling. And then one person awkwardly tried to clap and then got silent. And then about 30 seconds later, someone else started clapping and then everybody started clapping. And then they took us up front for the Q&A. And I looked out at the crowd for the first time and everybody was crying.
Wow.
And I was like, holy shit, I guess that it worked then. And then throughout the entire Q&A, that's just people like, they're trying to talk and they're still sobbing. You're like, oh my God, you just, I'm so sorry. You ruined me. I'm trying to ask you a question. I can't stop crying. And that's been the case with pretty much every screening we have now. By the end of it, it's not necessarily the entire crowd every time, but a lot of people are weeping. And I found that like the horror crowd, like It Scares the Care, we played it. There's a couple parts where people kind of, awkwardly laugh because they get very uncomfortable with what's happening on screen. And I think that's more of a horror crowd sort of thing, because most people are just stock silent, which, you know, either one is fine by me. It's fun, but.
Now, so where did the I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday story come from, and how long did it actually take you to make the film?
Well, to answer the second part of that, it took 3 years to make it. Which that's where the micro budget comes in. We shot it on weekends for 2 years, and then we had about a year of post-production. So that was horrible. I would not recommend anybody try to make a full-length movie that way. but it was actually based on a short story that I had published in 2012 by the same name. And that came about, my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney failure, and she was in the ICU for close to a year. When we got her into the hospital, she'd been throwing up on a daily basis and wasn't telling anybody. So I finally convinced her to go to the doctor when I found out. And they said, Mrs. Lombardi, your kidneys are operating at 4%. And they admitted her into the ICU, and then she stayed there for quite some time, like on the brink of dialysis / kidney transplant. Fortunately, that did not happen. But that was one of the hardest years of my life. And to go in there and try, I was kind of the go-between between my family and the doctors because I was the only one who was still local. To kind of soften the blow to the family and even my mom, you know, in the hospital, I would talk to the doctors and then kind of relay the news but try to make it as optimistic sounding as possible and just kind of hide reality. The worst thing you can possibly do when someone that you care about is sick or in pain is to break down in front of them. It's not going to help anything. So I kind of had to be the rock. And growing up, my mom was always that. You know, I went through some pretty horrible shit as a kid. My dad was in a really bad accident. And she ended up working 4 jobs to raise me and my 3 brothers. And no matter how bad things got emotionally or financially, you know, we always had birthdays. We always had Christmas. She always made the best out of what we had. And that kind of turned into the story. And I wrote a story about how helpless and powerless you feel when someone that you care about is fading away or in trouble and you can't do anything to help them. And I vented all the frustration and anxiety and fear and depression into that story and, fired it off into the submission call and it got accepted. And then the reviews for it that came in for the book, it's mostly bizarro stories. It's called A Very Strange House Christmas, as the anthology. Most of it's really funny and kind of offbeat. And mine was the last story in the book. And some of the reviews, one person reviewed it and said they wanted to slit their fucking wrists at the end of it. That was a direct quote. I was like, oh my God. Like, and I was like, Jesus, that was an insult. I didn't understand how heavily this was going to hit people. And over the next couple of years, you know, people would email me, message me, and they're just like, Jesus, man, like that really, that was rough. And then, you know, it started coming into, hey, you should make this into a movie. And I was like, how the hell am I going to make an apocalyptic Christmas movie with, like, $5? I can't do that. And the one day I just sat down and I started breaking down the script. And, you know, we're very big on being, like, kind of MacGyver when it comes to making movies. You know, you kind of take whatever junk's laying around and you make it work. And I broke it down. I'm like, you know what? I think we might be able to pull this off. So we started to make a short film. I had a script. And about halfway through the production of it, I was doing a rough cut of it, and I was like, wow, this is already like 35 minutes long, and it's only half done. So at that point, that's when Brian Keene came on board as an executive producer and bailed us out because we didn't have any money left, and some other people came in and very generously donated some money and their time and gear, and we accidentally made a feature-length film.
Well, the finished product is well worth the wait. The people who may still have a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. It's stark, it's bleak, it's poignant, and there are a couple of heartwarming moments in there before you know, come back around with the devastation boomerang. I'm just curious, some of the shots, I mean, some of the locations that you were shooting in looked completely abandoned and desolate. Were those places you had to go find, or were those places you knew about?
So they absolutely were abandoned and desolate. One of the reasons that I was able to make the movie was I had met a fellow who goes by the name Taruga at a film festival here in a local film festival that I'm a judge for. And he had mentioned, he's like, you know, I'd really like to help out on one of your films. And I was like, yeah, sure, you know, keep in touch. And he actually Facebook messaged me while I was in the middle of breaking down the script for White Doomsday. And he's like, hey, you know, are you working on anything? Is there anything I can help with? And I was like, yeah, you don't happen to have like a half dozen abandoned locations we could shoot at, do you? And, you know, like laughing. And like not even 30 seconds later, he started sending me photographs of pretty much every location we used in that movie. And he's an urban explorer, which I was not aware of at the time. So he had found all those places and took photos. And so he took me out for, I think it was like a 9-hour location scouting trip a couple days later. And we just kind of went to all these places and figured out, you know, would it work? And I will say that we may or may not have had permission to shoot in many of them. But when you're working on a no budget, you just kind of make do. So stealth was the order of the day in a lot of those, although it was also like the one day when you first see Santa, that was -12 degrees outside.
Oh, wow.
The wind chill. Yeah, it was the coldest day on record here. But we knew that area would not be patrolled by police that day, which it usually was patrolled, because, you know, people trespass on it all the time. So we picked that day to go out there and shoot that stuff because we knew we would be able to get away with it, so... That was one of the most hellish experiences of my entire life. But as a testament to my crew and my cast, they put up with it and they did it. And but yeah, and then the abandoned house, all of the interiors for that were actually one of my producers, Eric Mearns, who also did the soundtrack. It was his girlfriend at the time. Her stepfather had this house that he was remodeling. It was a really, really old house, but he had injured his rotator cuff, so he couldn't do it anymore. So it kind of just sat vacant for about a decade, and it just got used for storage. So we were able to use that. So almost all of the inside house stuff that you see is that one house, which when the Blu-ray comes out, you'll be able to see there's a documentary called Armageddon from the Cheap Seats. And we have footage. You can actually do a walkthrough of the house where every room is a different set piece for the movie. So you'll be able to actually see all of that. But without those locations, without Rachel and Taruga, the movie would not have been possible.
Other than dodging cops and shooting in Arctic temperatures, what was the most challenging part? Yeah. I mean, Arctic freeze and dodging cops. I mean, that's a reality show right there.
I like that.
It really is. But what was, I mean, because there aren't a lot of effects in this, but the ones that are just right spot on. But were there other shooting challenges, like for space? Because I know some of those bases looked kind of tight.
Oh my god. The stall was the first time I had experience shooting in confined spaces, because like a fool, I decided that the second half of that movie was going to only take place inside of the bathroom stall without any cutaways. Well, we didn't have a set. We were shooting in an actual bathroom stall, so cramming 7 crew members in and around a 3x3 space was horrible. But it was great practice for what would become my day-to-day life on Andre Move Away Doomsday. That basement bomb shelter that we used was actually a friend, Jeff Cooper, who's a very, very excellent author. He had just moved into a house right next to the Susquehanna River, and it was probably, I think, 200 years old, I want to say, and it was actually the last place that we had scouted for a bomb shelter location. I was getting really worried because we couldn't find a place that worked, and he's like, you got to check this basement out, so I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. So we go down there, and it was like he ripped a set out of the book and just made it reality. I was like, holy shit. It was perfect. The only problem was it was so damn tiny. And again, when you see the behind-the-scenes documentary, you'll see just how small the space was. But we had, you know, the mom and the kid, and then our camera guy. We had a lighting guy. We had me. We had the boom guy, you know, a couple other random crew members. I mean, we had 7-8 people crammed into an area that was literally maybe 7x7. Like, it was so small, and we had to use a lot of wide-angle lenses and stuff, which is a kind of a pain in the ass, because a lot of the shots that I wanted to get just weren't possible. And generally, when you're filming in a location that small, well, you would, if you were intelligent and had money, you'd build a set, which would allow you to be able to light from above. Like, there's always a grid on movie sets where you can hang lights, but we didn't have that option, so we had to use tripods, light stands, which take up even more space. And that was really restrictive as far as what kind of, where we could put the camera and all of that. So that was a huge, huge, huge pain in the ass. But also just being down there in such small quarters with that many people, it was also really dirty. And it was a 200-year-old house. I mean, we would be down there for 16, 17 hours at a time, and you would get out of there and you would sneeze black. Like, literally, it was like being in a coal mine. It was so filthy down there. And, like, that mattress they're sleeping on, if you stepped on it, a cloud, like a mushroom cloud of dirt would just come out of it. It was hideous. But it worked really well. You know, it got everybody into character, for sure, because they all, you know, were miserable. So it kind of fit the tone of the movie. But, yeah, that and the cold, of course. Because, you know, it was either scorching hot down in the bomb shelter, or it was 5 degrees outside for everywhere else we were shooting. Because our abandoned locations didn't have any power, so there's no heat or running water or, you know, any of the other things that most people enjoy in the modern world. So it was pretty horrible.
What would you, as a filmmaker with experience with, shall we say, challenging shoots and challenging budgets, what advice would you give to somebody else who's thinking about getting into the independent film genre, whether it be for horror shorts or sci-fi shorts? What would you put down as your top three recommendations?
That's a good question. So if you are looking to get to pursue indie filmmaking as a career, my number one, absolutely top tier, most important advice is get your head out of your ass and get a real job. Don't ever, ever try to make movies. It's a terrible life. You don't want it. Number two, if you're not going to listen to that, then understand that it will ruin your life. There will be no money. If it's not a compulsion for you, if it's not an absolute need to make movies, then you're not cut out for it. And the only reason I'm not trying to sound dissuasive. It's just so many people that I've worked with as an effects artist, I get onto their set and they have no idea what they're getting into. And then they stop halfway through. And it's a rough thing. But, you know, some people, if you're cut out for the guerrilla filmmaking lifestyle, then, you know, the best thing you can do is be MacGyver. Make the most out of what you have. Do what you can with what you've got. And thrift stores, secondhand shops, yard sales, Craigslist, that's where you're going to find all of your props, your costumes. That's where you're going to save all your money. And, you know, one of the big things about making props that I've discovered over the years is when you're trying to make things, a lot of people, their first instinct is to go and try to buy whatever their object is. Like, let's say you need a, this is a good example. I was doing a music video for a friend of mine. They needed an electric chair switch. You know, they dramatically pull and it starts the electric chair. So you can't buy one of those. And to buy something that kind of looks like that, like an old piece of electrical equipment, is very expensive. So we went out to Walmart and we found a child slingshot that has that rough shape, and we spray painted it. And we glued it to a piece of wood and spray painted that, faux painted it, and then, you know, it's all about form, not function. So, like, the bomb shelter door was made out of styrofoam, a PlayStation 1 steering wheel controller, and water bottle caps for bolts. So you kind of have to look at objects and see, what does the shape look like? What can I... You have to pretend it's not what it is and then say, okay, how can I assemble this to look like something, because a paint job will completely change everything. That door weighs like 2 ounces. Everyone asked me, how did you get a piece of brushed steel that big? And I'm like, I didn't. It's made of, it's nothing. It's made of garbage, literally. So you have to kind of figure that kind of stuff out. And the other really, really huge thing is feed your crew. Feed your cast and crew. If you spend money on nothing else, make sure that they are well fed, because if they aren't, they will mutiny. And when you're working under extreme conditions like this, a hot meal is the absolute least you can do. And the other thing is, to kind of piggyback on all that, like, I'm really big about treating the cast and crew well. I mean, I know that I talked about how miserable the conditions were, and they were, but at no point was anybody ever put into a situation that I myself would not do first. And I wouldn't ask anyone to do that. No one should ever be put into a situation where they have to do something dangerous. And if they are going to be put into a situation where they may get arrested for trespassing, for instance, like we were, I sat them down and I gave everyone the speech. I'm like, this is the potential of what could happen if we are caught. This is what it would be. If you're not okay with this, I completely understand. We will change the script. We will not do this. But everybody agreed, because I was concerned about their safety and their well-being, and I treated everybody with respect. And that's why they stuck it out as long as they did. And if you're not treating your cast and crew with respect, then you have no business picking up a camera.
Yeah, agreed. So where are some places that people might be able to still catch I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday?
So we're actually playing the end of the month. We are playing in Toronto at the Toronto Indie Horror Fest. I'm not sure the date on that one offhand. We will unfortunately not be at that one. And then also in, I believe, early September, we'll be in Austria, the Steel City Underground Film Festival, which is run by James Quinn. And what's really cool about that one is they actually took all of the films and they transferred them onto actual 16mm film. So they struck prints and then they are projecting that. So that's really exciting to see White Doomsday on film. Unfortunately, I won't be able to attend that one either, because it costs way too much to travel. But then there is hopefully going to be about 3 or 4 more festivals after that that I can't announce anything yet. And after that, DVD and Blu-ray, I'm not really allowed to say, but there are plans for that. And I will say that if all goes according to plan, it will be available before Christmas.
So if everything goes right, this will be something that someone could buy as a stocking stuffer.
Absolutely. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Well, for people who may still be in a position to see I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday, I highly recommend it. The trailer for it can be found on Mike's YouTube channel and his Real Splatter website, realsplatter.com, correct?
Yep, that's Real with 2 E's, like a reel of film.
Yep. And you can also experience some of his previous short films, which are, I'm going to say, notorious. Yes, they are notorious. Splatter seems to have been a favorite hallmark of yours for a few years.
Yeah, so all the old shorts are horror comedy, which, you know, with Doomsday, it's the polar opposite. But yeah, we do. We definitely love the red stuff. Also, some offensive humor and questionable morals in the films. But yeah, they're generally very, very gory. And you know, I would like to get back to that at some point. It's just the place my life I'm at the moment. Like Doomsday, there's some there's a couple scenes of violence in that movie and little bits of gore, but they're, I went for quality over quantity. So they're a little bit nastier than what some of the other stuff was, but it's not, like, splashy. But some of the future projects, the script that I'm working on right now has a head explosion in it, so that's, you know, that's something to look forward to.
Ah, yes, Scanners. We need more movies like that.
Oh, absolutely. I was just watching. I just showed my girlfriend Videodrome last night.
Nice.
And the scene when James Woods shoots the guy, the spectacular optical guy with the cancer gun, and his starts tumors just start erupting from his face and his body, and he splits into pieces. It was I love it. I was like, they don't make movies like this anymore.
I'm remembering another one. There was, I think it was at the very, very end of The Fury. Did you remember? Do you remember that one?
Was that the Cronenberg movie? You know, The Brood?
No. It was a movie called The Fury. It starred Kirk Douglas, Andrew Stevens, and Amy Irving. Stevens and Irving were like psychic kids who were being kidnapped and brainwashed by some shady government agency, and Kirk Douglas is Andrew Stevens' father, and he's been trying to find him because he was told he was killed, but he was really kidnapped. And at the very end, Amy Irving does something very, very delightfully brutal and bloody to the main bad guy.
No, I have not seen it. I'll have to check it out. Is that an 80s movie?
Late 70s, maybe.
Okay, I'll check that out. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's very, very slow, very intense, kind of like... kind of like The Exorcist in a way, but you know, where it's very, very slow, quiet suspense drawn out, and
yeah,
then there
I love
are these
slow burns. These
big explosions of action, and more specifically, lots and lots and lots of blood.
I'll definitely check that. That sounds like right up my alley.
Yeah, so we will direct people to your website, your YouTube page. People, check out the short films. Horror comedy is something you said you want to get back to, right?
Yeah, I'd like to. The next script I'm working on, Masterwork, is kind of, it has one foot in either camp. It's got the darkness and the dramatic elements of Doomsday, but it's got a little bit of the off-kilter humor and violence of the old movies. So I'm hoping to, you know, it's more fun to do horror comedy than it is in bleak, nihilistic drama.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, I'm always, my personality and my personal life's kind of split down the middle with both of those elements, so I'm kind of slingshotting back and forth right now.
Cool. But, well, in continue to enjoy making films, because, like I said, the Dreaming of a White Doomsday is a awesome accomplishment, especially on the budget and time frame that you had it on.
Hoping to reduce one of those things and increase the other. So,
cool. Well, we will have links to Mike's websites where you can find his shorts and leave comments on them. Tell him what particular effects grossed you out the most.
Actually, if anyone out there is interested, there is a DVD, Suburban Holocaust, Real Splatter Volume 1. It's a collection of the shorts, with commentaries and some behind the scenes on the special effects. So if you're interested in indie filmmaking, every time we put out a DVD, I always try to include some tutorials to kind of help pay it forward a little bit. So check out that too, if you're so inclined.
Cool. Well, I will include a link to that in the show notes as well. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Welcome to Tales of the Black Badge, a Wynonna Earp fan podcast. WynonnaEarpPodcast.com. Thanks again for checking in, and I hope you all take care. I told that devil
to take you back. Tales of the Black Badge, presented by Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV.
This is Stephen Kilpatrick, host of Tales to Terrify, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
And and that's the last of my Scares That Cares interview subjects. Mike Lombardo, like I said, is somebody who I've heard of for several years, courtesy of The Horror Show with Brian Keene, which is a very entertaining and educational horror podcast for those of you who have not yet found it. I highly recommend it. And if you can see I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday at a screening, a film festival, or convention, horror convention near you, I highly recommend it. But since the Blu-ray is going to be out this year sometime, we don't know when, I highly recommend checking that out. I want to see the extras, the bonus features. I'm a sucker for creator commentary. You all know that. And hopefully this will have some really cool background stuff as well. I wish I could have recorded the Q&A at Scares That Care for this. Maybe next time, the next time I get to a film festival, I'll be able to record some Q&A sessions, because those are so cool. You get to hear the most interesting questions, because one person can't think up all the questions. Not even five people can think up all the questions. But I'm looking forward to seeing what he works on next. So, Lombardo, go forth, young man, go forth. In upcoming shows of Slice of Sci-Fi will, I hope soon, feature filmmakers, showrunners, and cast members from such shows as The Gifted, Midnight Texas, which I'm really looking forward to coming back. What else? See, everything else I'm looking forward to doesn't come back until 2019. Unless I get really, really lucky and score something from Daredevil. Daredevil Season 3 will be dropping on Netflix sometime in October or November. I have to go double check my dates, but when I saw the first trailer for that drop this week, I was joyful. If you haven't seen it yet, head on over to YouTube, check out Netflix's channel, and just savor the darkness that is oozing from poor, conflicted Matt Murdock's soul. It was like, what was it, in Season 2, when the Punisher said, "You're just one bad day away from being me"? I'm beginning to wonder if that bad day has or is about to happen. Either way, I'm looking forward to Daredevil. Daredevil is still one of my favorites. He's one of the first Marvel characters whose title I read back in the day. So much Marvel. Not enough time. Also trying to line up some guest hosts for Slice of Sci-Fi, people to do more geek chats with, so keep an eye out for that. But if you have any questions or comments, feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. If you're interested in potentially being a contributor to the website, shoot me an email. Also, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, TuneIn, and Krypton Radio. Working on Spotify, in case you're curious or needed a break from iTunes or other something more compatible with your fancy smartphones there. You can also leave us a review on iTunes or on Stitcher, please. All reviews help with our profile on those platforms and help other listeners find us. So thank you very much in advance for that. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. Yes, that's me doing the tweeting. You can follow us on YouTube and Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. Not doing the Facebook thing. Thank you so much to Neil for handling the Facebook matters over there. And of course, there is the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can chime in on the reviews. The guys are doing the movie reviews, the DVD reviews, the independent film reviews, and so much more. I don't know if you noticed, but we had a guest review, Lael Kidd. I managed to snag a copy of Supernatural Season 13 on Blu-ray for him, for which he returned the favor and provided a very energetic and entertaining review. Check out the video. It is linked from the website as well. I'd like to thank everyone who is supporting the show. Donations through Patreon and PayPal are most welcome. Everything that is donated goes to help keep the sites and the media online. If you want to help support our efforts here, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. I'd also like to thank the geek rock band Sci-Fried for their musical contribution to the show, the theme music you hear, and the interstitial snippets that they created that I so adore. I really do. I really do love what they do. If you enjoy your rock and roll with a geek flavor, you can check out their website, sci-fried.com, or check them out on YouTube. Like I said, very entertaining videos. My favorites are by far Zombie Prison Blues and A Tall Ship. Check those out. Let me know what you think about them. How about that? Anyway, that will do it for this episode. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.